fight to make ends meet. Keeps a man upon his feet. Just holding down his job. Tried to show he can't be bought. It takes every kind of people to make what life's about, yeah. Every kind of people to make the world go round. Someone's looking for a lead. His duty to a king or to a creed, protecting what he feels is right, fights against the wrong within his life. There's no profit in deceit. Honest men know that revenge does not taste sweet. Whether yellow, black or white, each and every man's the same inside. It takes every kind of people to make what life's about, yeah. Every kind of people just to make the world go round.
Takes every kind of people. That's true. That's Joe Cocker, one of my favorites, with Every Kind of People. It's from his 2004 album, Heart and Soul. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and the damage was done last night on Super Tuesday. And this is where we pick up from where we were discussing yesterday, talking about what alternatives are there for those of us who are in the progressive community to the duopoly's quadrennial charade. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton scored big, as you know, each winning 7 states. And this all but cleared their paths to the respective parties' nomination and eventual matchup, one would surmise, in the November general election. But we continue our discussion. We see how others have done. It's a very interesting vetting process. But again, this is the parties doing their business. Trump won Alabama, Massachusetts, Tennessee, Arkansas, Virginia, Vermont, and Georgia. Yes, he did. Texas went to Ted Cruz, and Hillary won Massachusetts, Alabama, Texas, Arkansas, Tennessee. She's, of course, on the Democratic side, Georgia, and we have Marco Rubio winning in Minnesota. We have John Kasich winning nothing, but he also fell behind Ben Carson, who also didn't win in any state. But that's where things stand. None of this is unexpected, but there is a great deal of meaning in the results of yesterday. It's not just about, quote, winning, unquote, but it's also how they won. Hillary Clinton wasted no time threatening that she will be going national, because, of course, she did this all by herself. And we know, as I had predicted here, that the black vote essentially put her way over the top. Yesterday's contest for the Democrats had 865 delegates up for grabs. This is all theoretical, because we'll get to the truth of it in a minute. And for the Republicans in the 11 states, 595 delegates were at stake. But when we do the math, we see something entirely different. At this point, it is calculated that Hillary Clinton has 1,034 delegates. 1,034 of the 2,383 needed to win the nomination. But what is significant is that of that 1,034 delegates, we have Hillary Clinton boasting 457 super delegates. Remember these people? I told you about the others who are not part of the rank and file within the Democratic Party. These are people who can do whatever, put their vote wherever they want to put their vote. They're not obligated at all by the Democratic Party's rules to basically support any particular candidate, as opposed to the regular schmoes. They have to go along. When a candidate wins the state, the candidate gets the regular delegates. The super delegates are a whole other matter. But in this particular round of elections, and this is just round four, she has practically half already of delegates pledged to her. This is not a democratic process. Compared to Bernie Sanders, with 408. Now, what is interesting about Bernie Sanders is that he won four states. Now, this is great. And it harkens back to the days of Jesse Jackson. It depends on how one defines winning. If Bernie Sanders, who just basically popped up on the national political scene in a presidential race just this election cycle, did not have a great deal of money in his campaign, and the money he raised, these were small donations, these were not corporate donations, these were not PAC donations to his campaign. He boasted that the average donation to his campaign was $27 from individuals as opposed to corporations or PAC money. But he won four states. Now, this is quite significant. And we have to see that in the context of our discussion yesterday. And it goes back exactly to Jesse Jackson. Jesse Jackson, in 1988, won 11 primaries. This was phenomenal. This was phenomenal. It was a great victory. And it is all the more significant, as I said, because of the odds. Bernie Sanders, I think, performed quite admirably. But the message here isn't just about how he won four states. The message here is in the potential of growing a movement that should sustain independent candidacies outside of the Democratic Party. Inasmuch as Sanders professes to be a democratic socialist, meaning he is democratic in the sense that he belongs to the parties running under its banner, but ostensibly professes an ideology that is also outside of the democratic mainstream, which is the same thing that Jesse Jackson did in 1984 and 1988. It is exactly the same thing Barack Obama did in 2008 and 2012, kind of you running as a, quote, Democrat, but with a slight difference. You're marketing yourself as not part of the establishment. We talked about this conundrum as it pertains to Bernie Sanders, not moving too far afield from the established order within the Democratic Party. But still, making enough of a difference, a differentiation, I should say, that entirely new sectors, entirely new constituencies are being energized. So this is a very significant thing, that despite the fact that Hillary Clinton, I mean, just was outspending him, she has tons of money, had lots of troops, had the black vote. These toadies running around trying to scare up the black vote so that she can get over, and she did. But with all of that effort, had the advantage of name recognition, had the advantage of being deeply rooted in the Democratic Party establishment, had the advantage of a compliant press. She had all these advantages, and still Bernie won 4 states. That says that she's vulnerable, and it also says something, that people do not like her. She should have won. There's no way, if she were a likable candidate, if she were one of those, you can't touch me at all kind of candidates, she could not and would not have yielded 4 states to Bernie Sanders. So she's not the great gift that she thinks she is or that people are saying she is. And Democrats are reading that. The Democratic voters are reading that sufficiently to give Bernie Sanders 4 states. That is extremely significant. Now, what happens with this? This is great currency. And this is where we started talking. Is Bernie going to now turn this over to the Democratic Party as a loyalist come November? Or is this... This investment going to be put toward forging a movement in as much as one has begun to be born? The people, somehow, we have clear evidence that Bernie Sanders is touching a chord the same way that Donald Trump is on the other side of that. We'll get to him in a minute. But the evidence is clear. If you look at winning very differently, it's not just the numbers. It would be great if Bernie Sanders, in fact, were to triumph decisively numerically, if only to teach this Democratic Party a lesson. But we have enough information and we have enough evidence to say that there appears to be some dissatisfaction between the electorate, the people who normally vote Democratic, and the people who are running and wanting that vote. There's a gulf there. Also, we should note that in these races, the Democratic turnout was low, lower than in the last presidential cycle. But that it was the black vote. Remember, I told you this, and I told you to watch South Carolina is where it was going to start, and the vote in the South is going to be the pivotal thing for Hillary Clinton's triumph. They're going to engineer it so that it comes from there. And that is why I shared with you the tape by Fannie Lou Hamer, discussing what the Democratic Party did in the South, in Mississippi, that forced her, like Bernie Sanders, like Jesse Jackson, like Shirley Chisholm, forced them to construct their own political base because the party was hostile to their ascendancy and even participation. But in the days of Fannie Lou Hamer, just outright, completely, predatory, and as racist as you could get, going all the way back, she was a sharecropper, for crying out loud. The slavery system was still in effect in Mississippi at the time that she attempted and organized and mobilized people to vote. And it wasn't just about voting to be part of the American people, as they now call everybody, the American people. No. It was to address the singular question that the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated by saying the black man has no rights, or the white man need respect, or that black people could never be full citizens of the United States. That has been the seminal question, that voting and all these other things literally seek to address. The Supreme Court had said back then that the laws were not written to protect black people and their rights. The laws were written to affirm white supremacy. The laws were written to proscribe the limits of black freedom, the freedom of blacks and other oppressed peoples in this country. But specific, the Constitution was specific, and the law is specific as it applies to African Americans. And it continues to today. And the irony here that Hillary Clinton has already been given great momentum. She has been propelled into a stratosphere she never on her own could achieve, ever. Because she is a known entity. She is bad news. She is one, and Donald Trump is the other. They are the two leading candidates representing the Democratic and Republican parties, respectively, and yet the most disliked candidates, most distrusted candidates, most reprehensible candidates by all polls. And yet they are achieving this level of popularity, and it has to do with, in the case of Hillary Clinton, a compliant media that refuses to remind voters, for example, that at this time she's under federal investigation again. Yet again, the target of a federal probe. She's presents herself, and the media allow us to believe that she's as pure as a driven snow because they're not discussing the many cardinal sins attached to Hillary Clinton. But nonetheless, they have created her, and they are buttressing their creation with sympathetic coverage and with selective amnesia. We don't recall any of these negative things attached to Hillary Clinton. She is the woman, i.e. white woman, running for America, running for the presidency, and we, the media, we have a job to do to support that. On the flip side of the coin, now they're turning on Donald Trump. Once again, he becomes, well, they're reverting him back to his German roots. He's becoming, they're giving him the kind of media coverage accorded Donald Trump, as his family name really is, Trump, D-R-U-M-P-F. And so they're now talking what a racist he is. These horrible things that they created, this monster. And now they have to expiate their own demons because now the media had been caught red-handed, and Donald Trump has made it very clear he despises them. It's a really fascinating thing. He's saying that the media are some of the most wretched people on the planet, and the things that they do are reprehensible, and these are the kinds of words he's using to describe this media who created him and brought him into fruition as a bona fide legitimate candidate. I asked from the beginning, does anybody understand what a news story is anymore in the newsrooms of America? Donald Trump burps and it became headline news. Everything Donald Trump did. And we know why. I explained why that happened. Because the expectation was he was going to throw millions of dollars at them for political campaign advertising. And that has not materialized. And people are mad as hell. The suits upstairs, the guys who determine, you know, what the profit margins ought to be in any election year, they're very upset about the fact that they've been had. But they gave him millions and millions of dollars of free coverage, and he has given them very little in return so far. So they're counting now on Hillary and her budget Jeb Bush's budget evaporated with his candidacy. Nobody else really has a lot of money to throw around. So it's either going to be Hillary Clinton or nobody else on the Democratic side, because they're not about to promote a, quote, socialist, unquote, the media. So they'll give the sympathetic coverage to Hillary Clinton, the so-called liberal media. And on the other side, they will still give the coverage to Donald Trump. Why? Because they now the media has literally done a kind of transformation, if you've noticed it. They've become, I mean, just raving, quote, conservatives, unquote. And you could read that word on its many different levels. You know, this word that they use, evangelicals, I explained that to you. That's white people who believe in God. They are evangelicals. Everybody else, you know, there's a black church, black people who go to church, and Latinos who go to church, and they're Catholics. But the evangelical vote, the white people who believe in the Bible and God, only they are called evangelicals. They made up a whole new word for them, the evangelicals. So we have all these things swimming around. And so we should note these primaries and the results of these primaries in as broad a view as possible. But we are clear that it is a structural repositioning. That's all. It is a repositioning by the system of the mechanisms of control and the mechanisms of white supremacy in the United States. It's undergoing a structural adjustment. That's all. But it has to do it now because, as I had been laying out to you, a dramatic shift is about to occur. We are on the cusp of it. A demographic shift is occurring. It will be complete by the year 2034. It has already undergone a dramatic, there has already been a dramatic change, a demographic change in several states already. As many as 11 states have crossed that demographic threshold, and whites are officially the minority populations in those states. Now, you couple that with the idea that the regular ruling elite, who by definition were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, their numbers have dwindled. For all kinds of reasons. But their numbers have dwindled. And history tells us, and the pattern is, that when this occurs, the elastic is put into definitions of whiteness in America. They relax the rules a little bit. Most recently, when these rules were relaxed, we had the Irish who were admitted to the circles of whiteness. We had Italians and some very few Eastern Europeans admitted into the circles of whiteness. In fact, there is a huge discussion right now occurring in the Jewish community where the question is, are we Jews or are we white? Because that is now the transition. There's a huge discussion about it. You read the papers in Israel. You see some of the columns here in some of the Jewish magazines. This is a major concern, a sense of the identity, the cultural identity is being assailed as Jews are being permitted to integrate into the American supremacist society as whites. And we have a scrubbing of other ethnic groups who, because they wish to belong or because the invitation is open just for a short while until the numbers of people identified by the Census Bureau as white in America are at a level where there's a certain comfort about numerical advantage, then they will the elastic will be cut and we go back to but in the meantime, we have in even among the candidates, this was what I discussed the other day, that even the candidates themselves, most all of them would never have been considered white people just a couple of generations ago. None of them. They all have, quote, they're all ethnic whites. But they're not real whites, as America defines whiteness. And it is very, very important to the power elite about maintaining that level of purity here. The people who control things have to be white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. That's the standing order. There's an accommodation being made at the moment where people like Donald Trump, Donald Trump, of the lineage of Trumpf from Germany, we have him in a leadership position that would never have happened a couple of decades ago. Never. It would not have happened at all. We have Hillary Clinton. She never would have emerged at all on the scene. The kind of white woman who would have been okay, I mean, even with some trouble because we live in a sexist society, would have been an Eleanor Roosevelt. See? But not a Hillary Rodham Clinton. Certainly not a Bill Clinton. No way. Not a Barack Obama. See? So in the circles of power, there is a realignment occurring as well, because in the end, the job of the people in power is to control the assets and the goodies and to maintain utter and complete control over everybody else in this apartheid America. You have to have somebody who is committed to doing that. I refer you again to the willingness. In fact, right away, Barack Obama just threw Reverend Wright right out of the proverbial bus and disavowed his spiritual leader because somebody felt that Reverend Wright was being racist, when in fact he was preaching in the grand tradition of the black preacher. Liberation theology. And that was so frightening to the power elite to whom Barack Obama early had genuflected before and pledged that he was just not going to disrupt the standing order. And he made that deal. He had to symbolically disavow his own spiritual leader, who everybody admired, who everybody had known for so many years as being a man true to his word and true to his Bible and his God and true to the tradition of fiery liberation theology. Now, they're demanding the same thing of Donald Trump, who has not yet made it clear about his father's supposed association with the Ku Klux Klan. See? So we see that there isn't a disconnect here at all. It's the same thing, except we must be aware that this is not just an election. This is a realignment of the axis of power in the United States. And at the same time, the fact that the United States is undergoing a major shift in terms of its demography, and within the circles of power themselves. This is a huge shift. And I find it amazing that it hasn't been addressed. People haven't picked up on this. The power elite are now confronting the reality that there is just way too much watering down of the genetic purity of the power, the circles of power. And so they're realigning. Ted Cruz is not running as a Latino. Marco Rubio is not running as a Latino. He will do that when it is important to cultivate a relationship of convenience with the Latino voting electorate. But they're running as white Latinos. There's no, you know, so far. I mean, if you've been following this campaign, Ted Cruz isn't talking to your standard issue Latino. He's not doing that. Marco Rubio is not talking to Latinos. He's not there as a candidate to encourage Mexicans to look at him as a good guy or Puerto Ricans. Not at all. He is a white man. He is, in that sense, literally Hispanic, as in from Spain. I'm from the plantocracy. I'm from the elite. I am white in orientation. Ben Carson, you look at him, he looks like a black guy. But when he starts talking, you go, Lord have mercy. I mean, how do we begin to bring this man home? And where is it? Where would his home be? Culturally, where would his home be? He's lost his way. He lost his way a long time ago. But he's not running as a black candidate. He's made that clear. So they have deracinated themselves. Even Bernie Sanders isn't running as a Jewish candidate. It's not part of his appeal at all. He's talking about capitalism and class. He's not talking race and culture, except lately. And he had to be brought, it had to be brought to his attention, despite the fact we heard him, I played the tape. He was clearly identified with Jesse Jackson in 1984, 1988. He clearly identified with the civil rights movement in the South. But as a national candidate, that had to take the back seat. His cultural identity and orientation, you see, for strategic purposes. He understood that he could not garner as much support. Or put the other way, he would garner even greater resistance and opposition if he were to incorporate his Jewish and Polish identity in this race. John Kasich, Polish or Ukrainian, but Eastern European. And you have here an unwillingness to deal with that as part of the cultural mix. It's more important for people to understand that the people running, we are the new white people. We are the new white people. And, you know, we have been given permission to enter the circles of whiteness. This is fascinating to me that it is observed and yet not discussed. Well, let's take your calls and you can tell us what you think about where things are going so far. But more importantly, let's talk about what we began to discuss yesterday, which is how do we organize something different? And on what basis would it be different? What should the response be from progressives to this charade that we are witnessing here that is made to look like an election, but which is, and I encourage you to see it this way, as the realignment, a restructuring of white supremacist power in the United States. That's what's going on. And they're getting their house in order, their houses in order, both on the Democratic and Republican sides. But we are not necessarily in gear to defend ourselves against it. We have a long way to go. And what is accounting for it? How do we fix this? What is the solution you see? We got some really interesting suggestions yesterday, and we will continue the discussion because I believe that one of the things that has happened is that people got totally lazy about this idea of activism and thinking, well, you know, things ain't so bad after all. And besides which, if something happens, we'll do something about it when the time comes. And it is going to be somebody else's job to do that, to do the heavy lifting. It will be somebody else's job to do it. But aren't we beyond that now? Haven't we progressed enough to trust in the system that is going to deliver what it says? It's going to assure our democracy that we have as a people. We have equal access to the throttle and brake of government. We hear all this good news, the employment is down and whatnot. So if you are not employed, it must be back to the old canard that you're unemployed because you're lazy. You're unemployed because you just don't have enough initiative. You're unemployed because you don't have ambition. There are jobs available. Well, you can work 3-4 jobs. That shows initiative. That shows an enterprising spirit. But we should, as a community, don't you think? We should, as a community, have some vehicle that registers our aggregate view and our say. It should be able to exact a price from this system and inflict a punishment when this does not happen, when these needs are not met, when these promises are broken. But do we have that at all? And why don't we? What should we do? 888-874-4888. Mott, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, you, Teresa, and to the family. Very interesting take. I've been enjoying your commentary, although I was out on this issue yesterday. But a couple things. This whole, even the raunchy Republicans, ingrained in their racism, meaning that Ryan and Mitch McConnell coming out and saying, oh, we don't support the... I mean, there's so much when you look at Lee Atwater and his use of the N-word and how he was telling people that they can't use that word but giving them other ways to talk in code. So there's a whole history there. And so that's great hypocrisy. But I think it would be a good idea for you to continue to talk and bring on some guests, see who will speak up from the Democratic Party and the Negroes who become a part of a Hillary's campaign in terms of their machine. They all going along with her corruption. And this whole thing with the super delegates, I mean, even the raunchy Republicans doesn't have anything that approaches where the super delegates, and by the way, let me just clarify, the talking point is they can vote either way. But since the elite of the Democratic Party, and including lobbyists and, you know, the dog catcher from Kalamazoo or wherever, they're going to be supporting Hillary. So no matter how well somebody like Bernie or somebody like him were to do, you know, and if people were to wake up in terms of his being the most authentic and honest of the candidates, it wouldn't make any difference. So I'd like to see you spend some time and see if we could get some clarification as to how they have framed it up, you know, made a fraudulent process, and I understand it since 1972. And I'll look for your comments and the other callers. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Well, I did talk about this question about the superdelegates because it was ironic, and I talked about how important they will be in this race, the kind of unseen factor. But it is no question in my mind that it undermines the integrity of the voting process. And I'm amazed that there hasn't been a slew of lawsuits challenging this process. Of course, each party would say, well, we are a party. These elections are essentially party elections. We make up our own rules. But if the rules are such that the intent of the voting or participating voters in these primaries can be eroded or negated by these free-floating people who have no particular allegiance to rules, and they can do whatever they want to do and undermine what people think would be a fair process, and that is okay, so that Hillary Clinton is running around acting like she's a candidate, knowing full well she already has half of them in her pocket. And that is as a result of, you know, loyalty to the party by these superdelegates. It is a quid pro quo. There are all kinds of arrangements, neat little arrangements, that they are fulfilling when they exercise their so-called vote, and it is the votes of the delegates, both regular delegates and the superdelegates, that will in fact result in the nomination of a candidate who will then go on to represent the party at the general election in November. So there seems to me a major case to be made about the integrity of the vote by these strange party rules, and these things are being done in behind closed doors, smoke-filled rooms, that kind of thing. Harkens back to those days. But I talked about that. But I think it is not too bad a suggestion at all to revisit this, because it is, in fact, an undermining of the vote. And here's the irony. The party engaging in this is the Democratic Party. The party that takes its name from the concept of one person, one vote. And this is how it's running. This is an amazing thing that is, to my mind, an absolute violation of the integrity of the vote. Thanks so much for your suggestion. I will follow it up. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. We have to continue just talking. We're starting and we will continue to talk, because I think a lot of education comes out of talking and exchanging information. We have the benefit. Many people have incredible amounts of information that they can throw into the pot, and we learn from each other. But we at least should begin the process of talking, because it, in my mind, leads to an awareness, a sharpening of our awareness about things, a broadening and deepening of our knowledge about things. And therefore, the more educated we are, the more informed our decisions and the more decisive our actions will be. I find it really deplorable that here we are in 2016, and we really don't have an engine that would basically harness the views of a huge community out there. People are feeling the way we do, in the same way that they're feeling about Trump the way they are, and feeling the way about Hillary Clinton the way they are. Where is our machine? How do we put in place a mechanism that allows our will to be felt and our muscles to be flexed? We have to do that. That's the name of the game here. Politics is about protecting your turf and you win gains and you protect them. You lobby and you fight like crazy for things that are necessary in our society that benefit the whole, not just the small few who have access to the throttle and brake of government, but the large population out here. This is what the concept is. We have so many people suffering so badly. And, you know, these things have now become just mere backdrops for, you know, convenient backdrops for electioneering. You know, so you stand symbolically in Flint. But, you know, the problem still persists. It persisted before you got there. It persists after you leave. And it, for just a soundbite and for the visual, it pays for you to just show up there for a little bit of time and talk about how you are with the people of Flint. What the heck does that mean? You haven't been able to deliver anything. Your mind isn't there. Your sympathies aren't there. And your concern isn't there. And certainly we have this being the standard operating procedure during election years. We have people just abusing. I mean, just it's just revolting what has happened in this election cycle so far. But we have also to blame the media for it. They created these monsters. They're responsible for them. And they are not likely to self-examine anytime soon. What role did we play in creating this distress? How have we accommodated the system? By our silence or by our capitulation or by our very jaundiced coverage? How have we participated in the propaganda? And they are certainly culpable. There's no question about that. But ultimately, communities of interest need to be formed. We need to be clear on some things that we can agree upon because it isn't new. It has been done before and to very encouraging success. I see Bernie Sanders wins the four states that he won. This is yet another reminder that it is not an impossible thing to do to organize at the national level. It isn't at all impossible to do. You can do it, and it needs to be done. There's no reason that we do not have a vibrant third party, fourth party, fifth party that people can turn to and say, you know, I am not with the duopoly. I won't invest in them, but I will support parties that advance ideas that are worth supporting. I will support that. This is what we have to do. The moment is here. And it shouldn't, all of this energy should not go to waste. Right this minute, there ought to be a parallel effort to Bernie Sanders' run, to the Green Party's run. Although, as you know, I have issues with the Green Party's approach to running. They don't seem to want to win anything. But this is a time to at least to retool and harness this energy, harness these feelings of alienation and anger by a large chunk of America, waiting for solutions and waiting for something to show up that will accommodate the investment that they are ready to make. But nobody's talking to them. The attitude seems to be, well, we hear, if you're smart, you will know that, and you will come to us. That's not how it works. You've got to organize in those communities that are so distressed. And we should be talking about how by November there should be something in place that could deal a very serious blow to both parties. Just dump this duopoly and give birth truly to something viable that allows us to move away from that model, which has served no purpose for many, many years now, or very little purpose, but certainly the return on investment has been negligible. So we've got to do it. In every instance where there were gains, it's because people mobilized in order to get them. This was not because there was some great beneficence and people saw the logic and the rightness of doing the right thing. No, they had to be forced to do it. And this is where we ought to be right now, figuring out ways that we can create institutions that outlast our egos and our lives. It should be able to go on, but we should be about creating structures that deal specifically with our interests and needs and that can deliver what we need and extract from the system what we need, and most importantly, be in a position to absolutely punish the system when it messes up. I thank you for joining me today. I thank you for participating and, of course, for your thoughts. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. I do enjoy hearing from you. It is always a pleasure to hear from you and to share your thoughts. I'm trying my best to keep pace with the correspondence, but I got to admit, you know, it's kind of outdoing me here a little bit, but I'm catching up. I really am. I'm trying to catch up as fast as I can. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. You could reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege. The word is privilege, I wanted to say. A great privilege to be in your company. I'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Every kind of people to make the world go round.